our headlines, retaliatory strikes against the UAE continue. The Yemeni army hits Abu Dhabi and Dubai with ballistic missiles and drones. Russia hits back at Britain's threat of sanctions over the situation in Ukraine, saying it will respond in kind if its businesses are attacked. And the African Union suspends Burkina Faso over the January coup that ousted President Roch Marc Christian Kabore. Thank you for joining us. The top story this hour, the Yemeni army says it has hit significant targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates and yet a fresh retaliatory strike. Spokesman for the army, Yahya Sari, says several Zulfaghar missiles hit very sensitive facilities in the capital Abu Dhabi, adding that several targets in Dubai were hit with unmanned aircraft. According to Sari, the objectives of the operations have been met. He also warned that the UAE will be under continued strikes as long as it launches operations against the people of Yemen. The army spokesman also warned Emirati citizens to stay away from sensitive facilities because they will be targeted in upcoming attacks. The UAE is part of the Saudi-led coalition that has waged a war on Yemen since March 2015. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed directly from war or indirectly from hunger and disease since then. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdullatif Al-Washili, explains if and when the Yemeni forces would eventually stop their attacks on Emirati sites. Let's take a listen.
The UAE has been escalating its operations, whether on the ground or the aerial attacks against the Yemeni people. So the Yemeni army will absolutely respond to these attacks and attack Emirati facilities. This third version of Yemen Storm operations will not be the last, even if the Emiratis announced withdrawing part of their forces in Yemen. The goal here is not only to make them or force them to withdraw some forces or stop the aerial attacks. Yemenis seek to expel all the Yemeni territories. They have to leave the Yemeni lands, and the Yemeni army will absolutely wage further attacks against whether Saudi Arabia or Emiratis. Yemeni people believe that the Saudi-led coalition, Saudi Arabia and the UAE are only proxies for the Israeli regime, so they will keep fighting these two regimes until the liberation of their land.
Moscow was threatening to respond if Britain moves to sanction Russian companies close to President Vladimir Putin. The Kremlin has expressed alarm, warning that any attack on those firms could backfire on British shareholders and Russian companies. Britain has said that it will tighten its sanctions on businesses and people linked to Putin if Russia invades Ukraine. The U.S. and its NATO allies accuse Russia of amassing troops near the border to attack Ukraine. Moscow rejects the accusation. It says its move is in response to NATO's deployments in Eastern Europe and Ukraine. Russia has demanded written guarantees against NATO's eastward expansion and the signing up of Ukraine as a member. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson receives an update on an internal government report into parties held in breach of lockdown at his Downing Street residence. A Cabinet Office spokesperson says Johnson will make a statement in Parliament later on Monday on the report. The investigation by a senior civil servant looked into a string of revelations of gatherings held on government premises during 2020 lockdown. The report is different from a separate investigation launched by police. The disclosure has caused worst crisis for Johnson, who now faces calls from across the political spectrum, including his own party colleagues, to quit. Johnson himself has not been consistent in his response to the revelations. He's gone from denying that such parties ever existed to denying knowledge of them to recently saying he believed them to be work events. The death of a famous and elderly photographer on the cold streets of Paris after being ignored for 9 hours has caused shock worldwide. The scandal is forcing France to re-examine how it treats its homeless people. Rami Mazohari has more from Paris.
What often passes for cultured Parisian cool has been exposed as deadly indifference to suffering humanity following the death of René Robert, a famous photographer of flamenco music. The 85-year-old fainted while on a walk in one of the most crowded areas of Paris. He couldn't get up and then tragically died of hypothermia after being ignored for 9 hours. The death has shocked France and has shamed the capital city in news worldwide. Robert died likely because people assumed he was just another street person in a fabulously rich city where homelessness is somehow a common sight. The person who finally checked on Robert was a homeless person who probably knew all too well the indifference of Paris to people sleeping rough, even in winter.
We keep repeating the same things. Everyone needs access to a life with dignity. We ask for structural reforms which will have real impact on the lives of people living in precarious existence. There has been a disengagement from France regarding the basic social minimums required in life.
Officially, around 6,000 people die on the streets of France each year, but NGOs say the real number is closer to 3,000 people. Refugees, mostly from countries hit by Western military intervention, die out of sight and without identification in tents, pushed into unseen and unlivable corners of the country.
We consider the question of housing to be a vital effort we need to make. We are asking for the basic recognition that everyone needs a roof over their heads. We're asking all the candidates in this spring's election to recognize that a state must take care of people.
Annual budget cuts during the age of austerity have pushed even more poor and mentally ill people into the streets, with evictions exploding so much the government refuses to publish the data anymore. Paris is the most population-dense city in the Western world, but government housing policy favors landlords and not renters. None of these government policy choices really explains the passing of René Robert, but many hope his needless death can change France's indifference towards the plight of those living on the streets. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
Moving on, the African Union suspends Burkina Faso from the continental bloc in response to a recent military coup and ouster of President Roch Kabore. The bloc's 15-member Peace and Security Council says it has voted to suspend Burkina Faso from all its activities until the country effectively restores its constitutional order. The AU's move comes 3 days after a political and economic union of West African states, ECOWAS, also suspended Ouagadougou from the grouping and warned of possible sanctions. An ECOWAS delegation, along with a UN envoy, is due to visit Burkina Faso to meet with coup leaders before deciding on their next steps. After announcing the overthrow of President Kabore last week, the army said it has suspended the constitution, dissolved the government, and the National Assembly. Coup leaders claim the country would return to normalcy once the conditions are right. And now the latest from the Vienna talks on the revival of Iran's deal known as the JCPOA. Tehran says these negotiations will conclude once other signatories plus Washington make the right political decisions. Foreign Ministry spokesman says a proper response to Iran's rightful demands will result in an agreement in the shortest possible time. Said Khatibzadeh says this deal will be reliable if other sides do not make any requests beyond the scope and framework of the 2015 deal. It says the sources of disagreement between the negotiating parties are clear, adding there are yet unresolved issues regarding the removal of sanctions in a verifiable manner. Khatibzadeh stressed that Washington needs to provide sufficient guarantees that it will not again violate international law or target different entities with transnational sanctions. The negotiating delegations will go back to Vienna to resume talks in the coming days. Mohammad Marandi is an advisor to the Iranian negotiating team in Vienna. He gives a recap of the basic elements in these negotiations and how they are proceeding. Here's more.
They reached a point where those issues that need to be, that remain to be resolved, require major political decisions. And Tehran believes that the United States and its European allies have to make key decisions. If they want a nuclear deal, they're going to have to accept lifting sanctions. They can't expect Iran to go back to 2015 and implement the deal as it was back then. And then they remain with a framework of sanctions that they can use against ordinary people. That's just simply not acceptable. So they have to go back to their capitals. The Iranian delegation has come back to Tehran, and after a few days, they will be meeting again in Vienna to see where they can take things from there. Many issues have been resolved. As you know, a number of people from the American delegation were sent home, basically, arguably because the United States felt it had to be more flexible, and those two or three people were preventing that from happening. But still, that is not enough.
Reports are emerging of Lebanese intelligence services dismantling over a dozen Israeli espionage networks in the past month. Local media say the networks operated independently of each other in both Lebanon and Syria. A number of arrests have been made in this connection. Some of the detainees had been using drones to collect intelligence. The Israeli spy networks reportedly collected information about Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah and infiltrated into security services. This is the largest security operation carried out since 2009, when networks belonging to the Israeli intelligence service Mossad were dismantled. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, joined us earlier with the latest on the dismantling of a vast Israeli spy rank by Lebanese intelligence services. Let's take a listen.
And Hezbollah's resistance in cooperation with the intelligence and the army and internal security forces, they are always, of course, on high alert and always ready to see that there would be some sort of infiltration by Israeli agents. But now, with the fact that you have more normalization of ties with Arab states between Israel and the Zionist entity and Arab states, then therefore this puts Lebanon under the scrutiny more of those agents that are able to go back and forth easily to Arab states, since it is not illegal to go to those Arab states where they could be meeting with Israelis. They could have a better contact with the Israelis that way. In addition to the fact that with the 2019 protests, you have a wider array of non-governmental groups and organizations which work under the umbrella of the U.S. Embassy, basically, and that also makes it more possible for them to contact Israelis, and this is why this could probably be just one of the examples. We could probably see more examples and samples of sort of collaboration with Israelis.
People in Gaza protested to drum up support for thousands of Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails, especially those held under administrative detention. Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes. Ashraf Shannon brings us more in this report from Gaza.
Prisoners, rights activists, and families of Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails held a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They are protesting Israel's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners. Palestinian prisoners see no end to their suffering. Hundreds of them are held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention policy, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. In 2021 alone, Israeli courts issued 1,595 administrative detention orders against Palestinian prisoners.
There are around 500 Palestinian administrative detainees inside Israeli prisons. For the second month, they are boycotting the Israeli military courts in order to protest the administrative detention where they are facing inside the Israeli prisons. This step is aiming to stop this use of the administrative detention.
Many Palestinian prisoners suffer from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical treatment by Israel's prison service, which runs Israeli jails. Securing the release of prisoners is a highly significant issue for Palestinians, who regard them as prisoners of war and as symbols of resistance against Israeli occupation. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, has vowed to use all forms of resistance to free Palestinian prisoners.
We hold the Israeli regime fully responsible for the lives of Palestinian prisoners, and we assert the Palestinian people's right to use all forms of resistance against the Zionist enemy in order to secure the release of the prisoners. Armed resistance is the key to liberate Palestinian prisoners.
Under the Fourth Geneva Convention, the Israeli regime is legally responsible for the life and well-being of Palestinian prisoners and detainees. According to statistics published by rights groups, the Israeli regime has issued over 50,000 administrative detention orders against Palestinians, including women and minors, since 1967. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Canada's capital city at a standstill for a second day as truckers join thousands of demonstrators to protest vaccine mandates. Trucks continue to block the streets near Parliament in Ottawa, with some drivers saying they will not leave until the mandates are overturned. Truckers and protesters have also blocked a Canada-U.S. border crossing in southern Alberta. Authorities are describing the situation as high risk, adding that police resources are fully stretched in dealing with the obstruction. On Saturday, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his family were moved to an undisclosed location in Ottawa out of fears for their safety as a protest was going on. The so-called Freedom Convoy started out as a rally of truckers against vaccine requirements for cross-border drivers, but it soon turned into a general protest against COVID restrictions, including vaccine passports and lockdowns.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Findings from a pilot study involving 36 patients raised the possibility that COVID may cause microscopic damage to the lungs that is not detected using routine tests. We'll prepare for you an article written jointly by Hannah Devlin and Nicola Davis. The piece is titled Long COVID Study Finds Abnormality in Lungs That Could Explain Breathlessness. Abnormalities have been identified in the lungs of long COVID patients that could offer a potential explanation for why some people experience breathlessness long after their initial infection. The findings from a pilot study involving 36 patients raised the possibility that COVID may cause microscopic damage to the lungs that is not detected using routine tests. Breathlessness is a symptom in the majority of long COVID patients, but it has been unclear whether this is linked to other factors such as changes in breathing patterns, tiredness, or something more fundamental. According to Dr. Emily Fraser, a consultant at Oxford University Hospital and a co-author of the study, the latest findings are the first evidence that underlying lung health could be impaired. Dr. Emily Fraser said, "It is the first study to demonstrate lung abnormalities in people with long COVID who are breathless and where other investigations are unremarkable. It does suggest the virus is causing some kind of persistent abnormality within the microstructure of the lungs or in the pulmonary vasculature." She added more work would be required to clarify the clinical significance of the findings, including how the apparent abnormalities relate to breathlessness. Claire Steeves, a clinical senior lecturer at King's College London who was not involved in the study, said the findings, would be of significant interest to anyone living with long-term breathlessness after COVID. She said they suggest that the efficiency of the lung in doing what it is meant to do, exchange carbon dioxide and oxygen, may be compromised, even though the structure of the lung appears normal. Adding, however, we really need to await the completion of the study to know whether these early findings are robust, and if so, how much they explain and what the ramifications are in terms of potential treatments. Emily Fraser and her colleagues are the latest group to highlight physiological differences seen in people with long COVID, with research published recently pointing to an antibody signature that could help identify those most at risk. The latest study, which is aiming to recruit 400 participants, is using a specialized magnetic resonance imaging technique in which patients breathe in xenon gas while lying in a scanner. The gas can be traced as it moves from the lungs into the bloodstream, giving a reading of how the lungs are functioning. This contrasts with CT scans, which show just the structure of the lungs. The pilot compared three groups: patients diagnosed with long COVID who have normal CT scans, people who had been hospitalized with COVID more than 3 months previously and were not experiencing long COVID, and a healthy control group. The initial results published on the BioRxiv preprint server show there is significantly impaired gas transfer from the lungs to the bloodstream in these long COVID patients, even when other tests are normal. Similar abnormalities have been detected in COVID patients who had been hospitalized with more severe disease. Professor Fergus Gleeson, a radiologist at Oxford University Hospital NHS Foundation Trust and the study's chief investigator, said, "These patients have never been in hospital and did not have an acute severe illness when they had their COVID-19 infection. Some of them have been experiencing their symptoms for a year after contracting COVID-19. Professor Fergus Gleeson said the team were now hoping to look at what proportion of patients with long COVID have abnormal scans and determine the significance of the abnormality and whether it improves over time. Dr. Emily Fraser said the findings did not undermine the relevance of rehabilitation programs, such as breathing retraining for those with disordered patterns of breathing, for instance. She said, "Rehabilitation strategies are really helpful. We can make progress and set people on the right track, so people shouldn't think I've got lung damage and so there's no point." Dr. Louise Siegfried, a public health specialist at the University of Oxford who was not involved in the research, said the findings highlighted the need for those who had continuing symptoms to be given comprehensive diagnostic assessments. She said, "These early findings are really interesting and in line with other emerging data on lung perfusion defects post-SARS-CoV-2 infection seen in adults as well as adolescents. Furthermore, research by the UK's Office for National Statistics suggests vaccination could reduce the risk of long COVID. The study of more than 6,000 adults found those who were double vaccinated had a 41% lower likelihood of self-reporting COVID symptoms 12 weeks after first testing positive. Overall, 9.5% of the double vaccinated group reported experiencing long COVID, defined as symptoms lasting more than 4 weeks, compared with 14.6% of a socio-demographically matched group who were unvaccinated. Dr. David Strain, a clinical senior lecturer at the University of Exeter Medical School and the British Medical Association's lead on long COVID, said the Office of National Statistics findings fitted with research published recently that showed low levels of certain antibodies were more common in those who developed long COVID than in patients who swiftly recovered. He said, "We know that the vaccines trigger these immune responses," adding, "If you approach a COVID infection with high levels of these immunoglobulins, it's less likely to become long COVID." Dr. David Strain noted that it was reassuring that vaccination appeared to mitigate the risk of long COVID. A limitation of the study was that because of the timing of the vaccination program, the double vaccinated participants were sampled at a later time point, 238 days on average, than those in the unvaccinated group. So changes in dominant COVID variants in circulation and other factors that varied over the course of the pandemic could have influenced the results. The study was also observational, and while the two groups were matched for age and other socioeconomic factors, there may have been other differences between the groups, meaning the study could not conclusively prove that vaccination caused the different rates of illness. Separately, the Office of National Statistics found that differences in death rates between people from different ethnic backgrounds have persisted since the start of the vaccination program, with the rate of death involving COVID highest for the Bangladeshi group, 5 times greater than white British group for males, 4.5 times greater for females, followed by the Pakistani group, 3.1 times for males and 2.6 times for females, and black Africans, 2.4 times for males and 1.7 times for females. In most cases, the different rates were explained by where people lived, social disadvantage, occupation, overall health, and vaccination status. However, the Bangladeshi group and Pakistani men remained at higher risk than average even after adjusting for these factors. Previous research highlighted a gene more common in South Asian populations that could place this group at high risk from COVID. Vahan Nafilyan of the Office of National Statistics said, "Today's analysis shows that since the vaccination program began, the risk of COVID-19 death has continued to be higher in most ethnic minority groups than in the white British group. For the first time, we show that the lower vaccination coverage in some ethnic groups also contributes to the elevated risk of COVID-19 death, particularly in the black African and black Caribbean groups." The latest data from the Office of National Statistics, based on swabs collected from randomly selected households, suggests that COVID infection levels fell in England, also in Wales and Scotland recently, although the trend was unclear in Northern Ireland. The estimate suggests about 2,629,000 people, or about 1 in 20 in England, had COVID in the week ending 22nd of January. The study also shows that while infection levels are falling in most age groups, they are rising in school-age children. Similar findings have been reported in other research, including the REACT-1 study, the latest results of which were released recently by Imperial College London. According to the Office of National Statistics figures for the week ending 22nd of January, the percentage of those testing positive for COVID increased in England among children between the ages of 2 and 6, as well as for those in school year 7 to 11, with almost 12% of the former and more than 6% of the latter testing positive. While some scientists have called for renewed efforts to vaccinate adolescents and expand the program to all children aged 5 and over, others have emphasized that COVID is generally a mild infection for the age group and that there is a tight risk-benefit involved. We'll be right back.
the gate of knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the Charter of Islamic Covenants based on Imam Ali alayhi salam's sermons, in Nahjul Balagha. We are presently discussing the third sermon, where Imam Ali alayhi salam gives an outline of the purpose behind his governance. But of course, in this sermon, he stresses about the importance of taking lessons from the previous generations, from the taking lessons from the evil actions of what previous people did, and the result of that, especially rulers who took into their hands to lead the community without divine authority. He tells us to think about these things. Think about the leaders, think about the community and what happened to it because of that. And of course, the polytheism that had arrived, which was in the form of allowing people to take control of the Islamic leadership who did not have any real authority from God, and they would lead based on their own whims and thoughts and desires. This was the problem that the community faced. But here is where Imam Ali alayhi salam stresses the importance of looking at history, of understanding and studying the generations of the past, to look at how we can solve the problems. And I mentioned the issue of the discussion of Sayyid Sharafuddin and what he did to solve the problems of the Shias in that population. There's a lot we can learn from these scholars. Inshallah, I'll just give a few examples of their role, and inshallah, we will then continue with our discussion.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
The scholars of the Muslim world, especially of the Shias, they have a very important role, and that role is to watch out for the community and for the people. We have got great scholars. The scholar I mentioned previously in the previous session was Sayyid Sharafuddin Amili, who a very, very powerful scholar who solved the problems of the Shias over there and in Lebanon, where they were suffering the worst forms of humiliation and degradation, but he brought them to the level of honor and respect. We have great scholars, of course. One of them is Sheikh Ansari. Sheikh Ansari, he was the biggest marja of his time, marja at-taqlid. That means he was a scholar who was all the people were following his methodology of lifestyle based on his jurisprudential rulings. At that time, there were, of course, when he left the world, there were three scholars. One of them was Marhum Haj Mirza Habibullah Rashti, and another one was Marhum Sayyid Hussein Kuh Kamari. Both of them are very great scholars. Mirza Habibullah Rashti had hundreds of students, and he would teach them, and he was a powerful scholar in jurisprudence and law. And then we also had Sayyid Hussein Kuh Kamari, a very, very powerful scholar. He himself also had hundreds of students under him, until 300, some of them say. And he was a powerful scholar, yet he was a very humble man also. There are stories about him that will surprise you, that this Sayyid Hussein Kuh Kamari was such that when, despite having all these students and everyone knew that he is the greatest scholar of his time, yet when Sheikh Ansari comes to Najaf, the same Sheikh Ansari who passed away, when he comes to Najaf, he tells him, he himself, and tells his old students to learn from Sheikh Ansari, because he found Sheikh Ansari to be more knowledgeable to him. Anyways, at that time when Sheikh Ansari passed away, we had Sayyid Hussein Kuh Kamari, Sayyid Mirza Habibullah Rashti, and we had another scholar called Sayyid Mirza Hassan Shirazi. These three scholars were the ones that were present after Sheikh Ansari.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, when Sheikh Ansari left this world, he was the source of guidance for all the Shias. But when he died, we had three scholars, three experts in jurisprudence, or we call here in Shia terminology, marja' taqlid, that means the center of obedience in terms of following them based on the rulings that they, extract from the teachings of the Prophet and the Holy Quran and the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. So now these three scholars sat down and they decided that for the sake of the unity of the Shias, instead of there being three scholars who are the centers of guidance, we have one center of guidance. And therefore two of them would vote in benefit of one, so that only one becomes the leader. And from all of them, the youngest was Sayyid Mirza Shirazi. And Sayyid Mirza Shirazi comes to them and tells them, look, we need to choose one person. That person who is very intelligent, who is clever, who is pious, who is a scholar, who has learned well, who has studied properly. And he should have insight. He should be able to look far, to be able to see the problems of the community, to see the future of humanity. Okay, in this Islamic society, we need a scholar like that. So the two other scholars who are older to him, who are elder to him, told him that Mirza Hassan Shirazi, you become the leader. You become the center of obedience and center of authority. For now, we trust you. And he was surprised because he was younger to them, and even according to himself, he felt that he had lesser knowledge than them, but they trusted him and they gave him the authority. Look at the way our leaders were, that instead of fighting for leadership and, forcing leadership upon amongst themselves, they were in fact ready to give it to others, because they knew that the leadership here means a divine authority that needs a stamp from a divine source. And therefore, this is a very important thing. It's not just a mere small issue that can be discussed and just, fought about in a simple manner. No, it is something that needs to be clearly, thought about and then applied in the society. This was how things were. Inshallah, we will discuss more about this issue and the discussions that we had regarding Imam Ali alayhi salam's statements in Nahjul Balagha in the sessions to come. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد ممجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump vowed on Saturday, 29th of January, that Republicans in Congress would launch investigations targeting President Joe Biden and his family if the party retakes either the House or the Senate in this year's midterm elections. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist John Bowden, writing for The Independent. The piece is titled, Trump Vows Republicans Will Retaliate for January 6 Probe, Investigate Biden If They Retake Congress. Former U.S. President Donald Trump vowed on Saturday, 29th of January, that Republicans in Congress would launch investigations targeting President Joe Biden and his family if the party retakes either the House or the Senate in this year's midterm elections. The former president spoke in Texas on Saturday night, 29th of January, as he vowed retaliation for the ongoing investigation being carried out by the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th, as well as the fraud investigation into his company, the Trump Organization, led by New York's Attorney General Letitia James. When Republicans retake Congress, the Biden corruption will be investigated and exposed, Trump told a crowd of his fans, which roared its support in response. Of the House committee, he added later, "What the unselect committee is doing, it's a disgrace." His remarks were his second in just a few weeks mentioning the ongoing investigation headed by Letitia James, who earlier this month unveiled the specific allegations of criminal activity her office is investigating. According to court filings, Letitia James's office believes the Trump Organization routinely misrepresented the values of its assets for tax purposes. Former president did not say what specific angle he thought GOP lawmakers would pursue in their hypothetical investigations into President Joe Biden, but he reiterated criticism of Hunter Biden's past work in Ukraine before Joe Biden took office, as well as the Biden family's other various business dealings. He also touted his support for Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, a Republican and loyal Trump supporter, and suggested that he take over the job of New York Attorney General Letitia James. "They want to put me in jail," Trump told a booing crowd. "This has been going on since I came down the escalator in Trump Tower 6 years ago." Donald Trump then once again faulted New York Attorney General Letitia James for her supposed political agenda centered around targeting him, pointing out her criticism of his business practices during her campaign for office. Letitia James's comments at the time came in response to well-reported accounts of the supposed criminal practices being employed by the Trump Organization, including congressional testimony from Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's former attorney. House Republicans have vowed retaliation against Democrats, specifically in the form of measures to strip specific Democratic House members seen as favorite enemies of the GOP base, like Representatives Adam Schiff and Ilhan Omar, of their committee assignments if they retake power. GOP leaders have yet to make many specific threats about investigating Joe Biden himself, while far-right members of the House GOP caucus have been vowing his impeachment for months. Even if Republicans retake the House this November, the 6th of January committee has several months to complete its investigation, which has already revealed embarrassing and politically damaging insights into the events of the day when Donald Trump's supporters attacked the Capitol on 6th of January 2021. In the months ahead, the committee is expected to continue its investigation, which may escalate into criminal prosecution for allies of the former president just months before Americans are set to decide control of the House and the Senate. Meanwhile, a billionaire Republican donor and Donald Trump's supporter donated the maximum allowed amount to Senator Joe Manchin after the West Virginia Democrat sank Joe Biden's signature domestic spending plan. The Build Back Better plan sought to boost health and social care and to help combat the climate crisis at a price tag of $1.75 trillion. Senator Joe Manchin, one of two key swing votes in the 50-50 Senate, used the Fox News Channel's Sunday interview in December to say he was finally a no on the legislation. The move appeared to surprise President Joe Biden, and enraged progressives, but Ken Langan was presumably delighted. The billionaire Republican donor and co-founder of Home Depot, Ken Langan, and author of a 2018 book called I Love Capitalism, had signaled his support for Senator Joe Manchin before the senator made his move on Build Back Better. "I don't see leadership anyplace in this country. Thank God for Joe Manchin," Ken Langan told CNBC in November. "I'm going to have one of the biggest fundraisers I've ever had for him. He's special, he's precious, and he's a great American." Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is hastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you. Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day. Here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a beautiful tradition which has been narrated from the first Imam, Imam Ali alayhi salam, regarding self-scrutiny. In Arabic, we call this Muraqibatun Nafs. to scrutinize oneself, to take it into account. This is one of those very good habits that every person should do. You know, this is something that, you know, everybody does, right? You know, people, you know, evaluate themselves, assess themselves. But usually we don't think about this as something necessary in matters of religion. We do it in, you know, in our, you know, in our schoolwork. You know, we do it in our business, on our, in our jobs. We rarely ever, you know, use this very good trait as far as religion and spirituality is concerned. Whereas this is something very important in religion, if we want to progress in religion and come out of this world, enter the hereafter with felicity, spiritual felicity, it's necessary for us to use this and to take this habit and adopt it in ourselves. In this tradition, the Imam says, the rational man must calculate his soul's misdeeds against religion, meaning you should weigh them against the edicts and the rules of religion and see, you know, if he has done something against religion. He should calculate his soul's misdeeds against religion, against and then reason, ethical virtues, and good moral conduct. Of course, here in this tradition, the Imam, he separates religion from reason, ethical virtues, and good moral conduct. Whereas, you know, this is a case where all of these things are in some way a part of our religion. You know, reason, we consider it as the inner hujjat, you know, the hujjat or the proof that God has, placed within us. It's a part of religion. So here, when the Imam is speaking about religion as opposed to reason, he's speaking about religion, the manifest religion, you know, the actual religion which has, you know, been revealed in the form of edicts and rules and these kind of things in the Quran and the Hadith. In continuation, the Imam says he must gather this information within himself, or write it down in a book and work at eradicating them. This is very interesting. Meaning either he should conduct this self-scrutiny and self-examination assessment and remember it and then think about it and act upon it, or if he can't remember it and keep it in his mind, he should even write it down. This is something very beautiful, that the Imam was so, this is such an important trait, that the Imam says that if he can't remember all of this, you know, this assessment, he should write it down, and then he should work at eradicating those faults and those mistakes from himself. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at self-scrutiny and its importance in Islam from the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Aqa for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.